Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really happy to have as my guest Peter Carey. His new book is His Illegal Self. It's published by Knopf. He's the two-time Booker Award winner whose Booker Award books were Oscar and Lucinda, and also The True History of the Kelly Gang. It's been a while since we've seen him here, and I was delighted by his new book, His Illegal Self. And one of its great pleasures for me was feeling in a boys' book way that I was witnessing the onrush of event with the characters, and not only with them, but there's a dual point of view in the book that provides for immediacy, almost as if the project was to ask, can one present two points of view from an omniscient narrator at the same time?
Yeah, well, it ends up being the project. But at the beginning, the very beginning, what I was trying to do was to tell the story of this little boy from his point of view. And I thought later about this, I thought that really one of the reasons that was so attractive to me is these are the first American characters I've ever written. And I've lived in New York City now for, 18 years? I've got American kids of my own. But still, it's not my country. It's not my history. It's not my place. And I think one of the advantages for me at the beginning in having this little boy was he was just a kid. You know, he didn't have to have everything right. And like me, you know, like, and so he becomes sort of a cloak in a sense. But that wasn't the only reason. There's all sorts of things to do with language and feeling and so on. But so I wrote quite a bit of it, and I thought it was well written. But I had this feeling, Michael, it was just sort of boring. And I kept on going back over and over and over, and I think, why is this boring? The kid didn't know everything that was at stake. And the minute I introduced the other point of view, his companion and friend, Dial, the older woman in his life, suddenly it all came alive because I'd invented her past. I knew what it was. I just hadn't written it. And so then, if I might be lengthy in my answers here, then your question is, you know, yes, it does absolutely become a project about having an omniscient narrator, and the narrator being able to sort of have a very intimate and privileged relationship with one character, and then a second later with the other character, to do the thing that we're sort of told we're not really meant to do, to switch points of view from one character to the next within a paragraph, you know, or so.
One of the pleasures is that usually when there are two characters, they're foils for one another, but both of these characters are innocents. And while the older one, who's known as Dial, may know the stakes, she's every bit as open to the world and as frightened by the world as the young 7-year-old boy, Che.
Yes, well, she's in a situation that she really does not know how to deal with. That's perhaps more terrifying, really, for her than it is for him, because the little boy sort of sometimes is feeling that everything's okay. He can take the kid's position that there's someone there who's going to look after it. And then, of course, he has moments of rage and terror when he realizes that that terrible moment in our lives as children, when we realize the adults maybe don't know what they're doing.
And we have here, it's set in 1972. He's 7 years old at the beginning of the story. But he's like the classic hero of a boy's adventure, like the boy in Treasure Island. And he does get to hide in Treasure Island. It's in a barrel. But here, a good deal of what he learns in the book is in the course of stealth and eavesdropping.
very good. I wouldn't have thought to put that together with Treasure Island, but of course it's exactly what he does. That's very beautiful. And that's how he learns things, yes.
And he is the child of two campus revolutionaries who've been in Harvard. They have had a child. The grandmother of the mother of the child has gained, what is the word for that?
Custody,
or supervisorship of the child. The mother is deemed irresponsible, having clutched the child like a football and rolled under a car at the visit of McNamara to the Harvard campus. And so now it's a kind of patrician lady, an East Side type, who's been raising the boy and seeing what's happened to her own daughter. She, you know, tends to think, God, I sent them to Harvard, and what did we get? Some Rosenbergs. And she wants to raise the boy Victorian, so he knows very little. Mm. And the unusual thing in this book is that from the first page on, things ordinarily that a child would be prepared for. Mm. Someone is coming to take you to see your long-absent mother are never said to the boy. Mm. He's lived a life that has forced him to be prepared for anything, mm. which is the condition of this narrative. The reader has to jump and hop to the same herkimer-jerk rhythms of life that the boy is encountering. Mm. Everything is coming at you without preparation.
Mm. Well, sometimes when, you know, this is the second time you've done it, I mean, that's beautiful, yes. Did I plan that? No.
Sure you did. You did.
I think there's a level. I mean, there is a level, surely, when things happen, they do happen. When you've been writing long enough, things sort of happen instinctively somehow. I mean, just a sidestep. But there's another book of mine which is called My Life is a Fake, which has a series of sort of Russian doll narrators. You know, one tells a story, and then someone tells that story. And that whole structure of that book, which should not, you would imagine, took amazing planning, just fell like dominoes. One thing worked, and the next thing worked, and the next thing worked. And I don't think it worked because I'm dumb, but I don't think it was luck. But on the other hand, I didn't really plan that at all.
Now, but I think, in fact, in this book, as I read it, I felt Peter Carey doesn't know what's going to happen as this book goes along. In fact, I felt as if it were a question all the way through whether the book would have a happy ending or not.
Huh. Well, the issue of the ending, of course, was huge. And because their predicament is so extreme, I had a real commitment to one thing that I saw from the beginning, that this would be an episode in the boy's life. That books finish, you know, they're meant to have a conclusion, but lives don't finish when the book finishes. Life goes on, and I wanted always to frame this in the sense that this person was going to go on and have, and this was something that he would remember all his life. And he might be somebody you might meet at the Harvard Club in New York City, sitting in the corner in a tweed coat, and he might be carrying this amazing, amazing adventure within that sort of skin. So I wanted to do that. I had a sense. I had a sort of an emotional sort of point for the ending, which the book sort of does, but I didn't know what it was, and I had left myself a lot of options. And as I continued to write, it sort of funneled in, and I'd sort of eliminate things. But even very, very close to the ending, I was inventing scenes that I never used, the things to do with American embassies in Sydney and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And I just slowly, I just moved forward, threw things away. But the thing that I wanted, the feeling that I wanted, I don't know if you remember this. I bet you will, actually, being you. But there's a thing, when the boy first runs away, and he goes along the road, and he's about to climb a hill going out of the valley, and a little blue kingfisher flies very low across the across the ford, across coming along the river, and I wrote that sort of really knowing that that's sort of how I wanted the ending to feel, that the magic of that moment for me, not for the reader, who I didn't expect would ever match that with the ending, but for me, I did want to do something that I didn't quite know how to do. I wanted to do something sort of that was sort of magical. It was beyond what I knew how to do. And I didn't really know I could do it till I actually did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that sometimes a tone is projected for the end of a book, and whether the writer can achieve it takes the whole book to find out. This has a kind of, you know, beautiful quality of strange and exuberant happiness as the people discover that what they've gone through has been an adventure rather than an ordeal necessarily, or at least they're going to accept it as an adventure. And it's very lovely. The whole tone of the book has a kind of shift. What had been lush and threatening becomes lush and comforting.
I'm so pleased for you that you said that. Because, and this is not much to do with the book, it's a bit to do with me. But you see, I once lived in a place rather like that, which I loved.
Queensland?
Yeah, loved it very, very much. And I think it was one of the great gifts of my life that I lived in that place. Not by my choice, but because I was living with a woman who wanted to go there. And the people I met there I really, really liked. And some I know still and admire. I mean, hippies are made fun of, but I think that these were courageous people who history has sort of shown to be sort of, generally speaking, right. But anyway, but the characters, of course, when they first arrive there, I mean, he's a little boy, from patrician boy from New York City. She's from South Boston. They're not going to like it. They don't want to be there. So, of course, the beginning of the book sort of filled with all their sort of fear and revulsion of the place. And I wanted them, in the end, for that to change and for that to be felt. Too many people have read it in New York and they say, oh, that was such a disgusting place. Oh, I couldn't go there. I hate that. So I feel bad when that happens.
Well, at first I was afraid to be there, but I realized that the book structures it actually carefully. The boys lived at a lakeside, and this isn't, in fact, the first time in his life that he's been plagued by little black ants there in Australia. Mm. He remembers the little black ants from the lakeside. And in fact, eventually, when you get used to it, they become your friends. Or at least it's not worth trying to kill all of them because it's pointless.
That's right.
And he's been told things that become meaningful later in his life when he hears them repeated. His babysitter and friend Cameron has told him that he has a right to know about his revolutionary parents. Mm. Later in the book, when he announces that he has a right to know, his mother figure thinks this has been said by one of the hippies, by someone trying to force him to confront her. Mm. But in fact, it's from New York and a childhood friend. In other words, things don't change all that much for a child switching cultures.
Mm. That's very interesting. I don't know what to add to it.
but I do wonder when is that part of what you might call the design of the book?
No.
So you're entirely instinctual.
Yes. I mean the journey for me, instinct is finding out what it means. And I mean, I knew some things, but I mean, I knew that at the end of this book, this boy was going to have felt love really intensely at least once in his life at that moment. I knew that. And but I didn't. I started at the very beginning. I knew there were two Americans, and one was a woman and one was a little boy, and I imagined them as a mother and son. And I imagine her as one of those sort of hippie mothers we used to know and see and on those roads, walking to a festival from a commune, trudging along with their little boy, and the little boy being fiercely protective of his mother, you know, chasing off the men. Any men, you know, those little boys were very tough for the men who might be attracted to the mother. And I imagine that sort of, and they're walking along a road north of Brisbane, a main arterial road, and there's a huge tropical storm coming, and all the cars are coming back into Brisbane with their lights on in the middle of the day. And I saw that picture, and I started to write the book. And I knew they were going to get picked up by hippies. I knew they were going to go and live somewhere they didn't understand. I knew that they were on the run. I didn't really know an awful lot about... I figured out her class background and figured out all the things about... I mean, I had the Harvard thing in my mind, that the Harvard radicals were very privileged and that she had to be not privileged. And
she's
somehow
a scholarship girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, and her father is a sausage maker.
Yeah.
Now, this is, again, another special relationship because we hear from Anna that despite what they say about her in the news weeklies, she's only actually had sex with one man in her life up to this point. So we're dealing again with a double awakening.
Help me.
The boy's knowledge of what parenthood and love is.
Right.
And the woman who seems on the verge of her second relationship, her awakening to what affection and intimacy are.
Yes, absolutely. And so you do this to me. You say this. I don't even know how to comment on it.
Well,
the insight's perfect. But, Michael, you're the reader. You're the reader that's ahead of the writer. In the sense that here am I. It's what you said. I am instinctive. I have a sort of plan and a geography, and I'm sitting there thinking, how will this person feel? What will this person do? If this person feels this, this person will feel that. This has got to happen. So, and there's not a lot of when one pulls it apart in the way that you're doing creatively, you're making sense of those of patterns that the writer was not necessarily at the top of the writer's mind.
I'm speaking with Peter Carey, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We're talking about His Illegal Self, the novel published recently by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Peter Carey about his new novel, His Illegal Self. Now, in recent years in your work, you've been moving away from some of the literal magic of the early works.
And sorry, the what magic?
The literal, the actual this is life magic that we're witnessing here. The earlier was often the supernatural the fanciful.
Yes.
And I wondered about that direction. Why did it start?
Well, I mean, the first part of it, the actual literally magical stuff, I think really probably emerges from a young writer's misunderstanding of what it might mean to be Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and the cultural roots of that work and what that meant and so on. I have always had from the thing that's consistent all the way through has been a desire to make something very beautiful that never existed in the world before, an ambition that seemed. I dreamed of on reading Faulkner for the first time as a very poorly read young man. And also a sort of a passion to see the familiar in a way that's new. And I used to, in the old days, say 1985, I wrote a book called Illywacker, and attempting to describe how I was trying to be magical about the commonplace, I would say to people, well, it's like if you look between your legs and see the world upside down. It's exactly the same, but all the colors have been intensified and the relationships are sort of new to you. And that's what I was trying to do with that particular book, which had quite a deal of sort of literal sort of magic in it. I think I'm still concerned. In a way, I thought when I'd finished his illegal self that in a way it was not unlike Illiwacka to the degree that it's making the familiar it's defamiliarizing the Australian environment that I love by having American characters looking at it and interacting with the Australian characters in a way that without any real knowledge of who they are. And I've become less and less and less interested in the sort of magic that might exist in Illiwacka and more sort of obsessed with the magic of the language and the words on the page and with a sort of a... And I think it started for me with the Kelly Gang, where I was able to write in a way which felt like what I'd always really wanted to do. I mean, you know, there are no commas. It has its roots in Australian vernacular. It's attempting to make a poetry out of an uneducated voice, and it feels like bending and snapping and nailing the language together in a new way. I mean, I love the work of Robert Rauschenberg and Rauschenberg. You know, the sort of great sort of sensualness and crudeness and occasional sort of slapdashery of it all is very attractive to me. So, and I started to also think about the word magic, that it was sort of important, I thought, for me and for writers generally to maybe more publicly claim the business of magic and the magic of what we do. Because too often, not in this studio, but out in the rest of the world, there's a very strong drive to reduce everything we write to based on this, to be very reductive about the sources of literature, as if we would really just sort of cowardly journalists who couldn't bring ourselves to really write down what really happened. And I think that it's very important that we sort of assert and claim we are magicians. I got this from Fellini. There's a Fellini documentary. I've forgotten what it's called. And this Fellini, of course, has no trouble saying I'm a magician. But I thought, well, maybe it's important to say we are magicians.
I want to ask you finally, because my great feeling of connection to this book has to do perhaps with... because it's set in 1972, there's more hope in it than there seems to be in novels set today. Mm. And I, to some extent, feel that I need the hopefulness that literature used to offer, but now would simply look like naivete or false hope or tragic deception. Mm. And, you know, I felt a real warmth and a gratitude to be given a story where my level of uncertainty is not reinforced. Things work out, says this book.
It becomes very important for us to believe that now. The things we imagine are important, no? I mean, what we imagine really does matter. And I think I agree with you. It's really very important for us as humans to be able to imagine something. What do you imagine?
People used to be, and maybe now again, are very opposed to literature that consoles. It's not supposed to reinforce the status quo. And yet I think that at the same time, the stories that we know best, fairy tales and children's books, they're there to satisfy soul hungers that, unslaked, produce lost people.
Yeah, I think the notion of sort of literature of sort of desolation and hopelessness is the sort of luxury of fat times, which we are not in. We're not in that. By the way, I'm not sitting down thinking whether I'm going to have an up ending or a down ending or any of those things. But when you say that, you know, these times are much bleaker and much tougher. And a lot of the, you know, of course, the 60s and 70s, as we remember them, were actually also very frightening periods, terrifying, you know, in terms of what one sense of what was opposed to us and the powers of the state and the police and so on. But I think that these times are way worse. And maybe we will see then that our desire for to hope, to imagine something better or a good resolution will begin to show in literature. It should.
I'm hoping so, because there is something like a down in the tooth realism occurring now, where writers, in representing the world as it is, are completely correct in showing corruption, ego, and ambitiousness. But you yearn for characters like yours, if not noble and good, at least capable of being surprised by the accident of goodness.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think that it's very hard now if you're thinking about the present. And, you know, I sometimes talk, you if you're talking about a country or thing, say, what do you think? How do you imagine the world is going to be in 5 years? How do you think it's going to be in 10 years? How do you think it's going to be in 20 years? My dear boys, who I love incredibly, who are smart, good kids, they can't imagine anything. My youngest son's 17 years old. This cannot go on. There is going to be a total collapse of the cities and all of these sort of things, and the world will have to start again. And that's where my kids are. In a cheerful, affectionate, weird sort of way, living their lives with grace and affection, still carry this within them. So I think it's very hard then. How do you get from that to imagining something that will sustain us through what are going to be really, really, really very difficult years ahead, centuries ahead?
Thank you. Thank you. I've been talking with Peter Carey, author most recently of His Illegal Self, published by Knopf. Thank you, Peter, for joining us.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from His Illegal Self at kcrw.com/bookworm. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Associate producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.